Hi, I'm Deborah Lynn Dadd, and this is Toxic Free Talk Radio, where we talk about how to thrive in a toxic world and live toxic free. It's Tuesday, September 15th, 2015. I'm here in Clearwater, Florida, and it's only 82 today instead of 95, so I know that autumn is on its way. Today, we're going to be talking about something that we haven't ever talked about on this show before, and that is, where do all these toxic chemicals come from? How come we have a toxic world now where 100 years ago we didn't and 200 years ago we didn't? What happened that now we have toxic chemicals in every part of our lives, in every consumer products, in the air we breathe, in the water we drink? Everything has toxic pollution in it now. And why is that? Where did that come from? My guest today is Richard Heinberg. He's a senior fellow out at the Post Carbon Institute. And I invited him to be a guest after I saw a wonderful video that he made called 300 Years of Fossil Fuels in 300 Seconds. It's had 1.3 million views, and if you want to take a look at it, and I hope you will, you can just go to toxicfreetalkradio.com and look for today's show, and I've embedded this video there. And this gives a summary of everything that's happened in the past 300 years that has taken us from basically living within the resources of the planet to having toxic chemicals all over the place and living beyond our resources. So I'm going to have Richard tell us about this in a little slower version, and we'll talk about it and find out where the toxic chemicals came from, but also what's happening that we are getting to the end of fossil fuels and how we're going to need to transition away from that. And I think what's going to happen is that as we lose our fossil fuels, we'll also lose the toxic chemicals. Hi, Richard.
Good morning, Deborah.
Thank you so much for being here.
Or is it afternoon where you are?
It is afternoon where I am.
Okay.
And morning where you are in California.
Yes.
I used to live in California. I lived out in West Marin in Forest Knolls.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know where that is?
I do, yeah. I'm a little bit north of there in Santa Rosa.
Yeah, and my father lived in Santa Rosa, and I also lived in Inverness, out by the ocean. And
yeah.
So I know your area where you are.
Yeah.
I was born in California. So anyway, tell us how you got interested in the subject of post-carbon and fossil fuels and everything that's happening that is creating our situation now.
Right. Well, I've always had sort of a curious mind, and by the 1980s, it was clear to me. I mean, a lot of other people had already picked up on this, but it was becoming clear to me that there were a lot of things going wonky in the world all at the same time.
Yes.
Our population was growing rapidly. The environment was being plundered in various ways. We were starting to see species extinctions at much higher rates than normal, and so on. So I was trying to figure out, why is this all happening at once? And I started applying all the kinds of answers that I could imagine. Was it something to do with politics? Was it something to do with economics? And I looked into these areas, and you know, clearly there were things going on that were at least partially responsible for these dramatic changes in human society. I started looking into anthropology and saw how human societies had evolved from hunting and gathering through horticulture and agriculture up to our modern industrial form of production.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't until the 1990s that I realized that the key to understanding the whole thing was energy. Energy is what enables us to do literally everything we do. Without energy, nothing happens.
Yeah.
And if you look through human history, our ability to harness more energy, whether it was in terms of planting food crops or literally harnessing horses and oxen, these things changed society, enabled the growth of civilizations. But when we get to the Industrial Revolution and the unleashing of fossil fuels, we see suddenly the harnessing of energy on a scale that simply was impossible previously.
Yes.
Fossil fuels carry energy that's in a concentrated form that's also portable and versatile. We're able to use it to do all the amazing things that we've done in the last 200 years, everything from transportation and cars and planes and trains and ships to the production of electricity to power all of our communications devices. None of this would have happened without fossil fuels. So fossil fuels obviously have given us enormous advantages. They've enabled the growth of industrial civilization, but we're also paying an enormous price because we've become addicted to energy sources that are inherently limited. I mean, these are non-renewable resources that we're extracting as fast as we possibly can and burning them once and for all so future generations will not have access to them. And
yes.
as we burn them and as we transform them into plastics and chemicals, we're also changing the environment. We're doing a massive chemistry experiment with the oceans and the atmosphere.
And the humans.
Absolutely. And human health and the health of livestock and wildlife and pets and everything else.
It's... I remember when I've been studying toxic chemicals in consumer products for more than 30 years, and I remember when I first started studying them and understanding that they came from fossil fuels and wanting to know these petrochemicals, how, I mean, were they just like digging them up out of the ground and making them into consumer products? And one of the things that I learned early on by reading like the Encyclopedia Britannica is, that fossil fuels are the reason that we are mining fossil fuels. Well, I'm not quite sure what the word is when you talk about obtaining them from the earth, extracting fossil fuels, is because of for fuel. They're being used for fuel, so they're rightly named fossil fuels. The reason that they're being made to make plastics and pharmaceuticals and everything else that they're being used to make is because when they come out of the ground in their raw state, and you probably could explain this better than I do, is that they come out as raw materials, and then they separate it out. I think it's a distillation process or something, and that at different temperatures, different parts of the oil or coal or whatever turn into different things. And so what they do is they take off the fuel, the gasoline or the oil or whatever, and then there's all this stuff left over. And in a way, the making of toxic chemicals that go into consumer products is a very responsible recycling project. It's recycling the waste from the making of fuel. And yet that is being recycled into us as poison. And therein lies the problem. And so it's not being extracted so that we can have plastic. It's being extracted for fuel. And the waste is being turned into products for us.
Right. Well, maybe calling it waste is possibly a little misleading because we're talking about organic chemistry here, and the fossil fuels are basically organic molecules. They were produced over hundreds of millions of years in some cases, or at least tens of millions of years, from ancient plant material. In the case of oil and gas, we're talking about algae and plankton primarily, with coal, peat, and in some cases forests. All of this material was compressed and chemically changed, with time and pressure, into long and short organic molecules, hydrocarbons.
Let me just interrupt you right there because we need to go to break. That's what the music's about.
Sure. Yeah.
And then you can explain it in more detail when we come back.
Sure.
You're listening to Toxic Free Talk Radio. I'm Deborah Lynn Dadd, and my guest today is Richard Heinberg from the Post Carbon Institute. And we're talking about how we got all these toxic chemicals, and we're going to be talking about what's going to happen when we run out of fossil fuels. He's with the Post Carbon Institute at postcarbon.org, and we'll be right back. You're listening to Toxic Free Talk Radio. I'm Deborah Lynn Dadd, and my guest today is Richard Heinberg from the Post Carbon Institute, and they're at postcarbon.org. And I want to mention again, he's got this great video, which is how I found out about him, called 300 Years of Fossil Fuels in 300 Seconds, and you can go to toxicfreetalkradio.com and watch that. Before we go on with your chemistry explanation, I just want to mention, a few years ago, I was watching on the History Channel a whole series of really excellent shows called The Men Who Built America, and I remember it was talking about some of these things that you talk about in the video, and especially there was a whole thing about the development of using fossil fuels and then showing how it was a really big environmental problem that they were taking oil and turning it into fuel for something. I don't remember kerosene or something, I think, that they were making. And then the rest of it was just, they showed this scene of the rest of it just being dumped into the environment. And I was just like looking at all this stuff just dumped into the environment. So, of course, it made sense that I think it was somebody came along, Henry Ford or somebody. No, somebody came along who built the engine using this waste product. I know you don't want me to say it's a waste product because you're going to tell us why. But the leftovers from the production of kerosene or whatever that turned into Standard Oil, and it's like all there in these shows. They're really, really well done, and it really showed me how this whole industrial thing happened. So you can just look up The Men Who Built America, and you'll get to the page, and all the shows are there on the History Channel. You can just watch them. Okay, go on.
Yeah, most likely the one that talks about Rockefeller would explain the early history of the oil industry. But as I was saying, that oil, natural gas, and coal also are hydrocarbons, which means that they are varying length chains of combinations of hydrogen and carbon atoms. And the simplest one is methane, which is the main constituent of natural gas, which is just one of these chains, and then one of these segments. And then you can add more of them. Octane, which is the main ingredient of gasoline, is, as the name suggests, eight of these kinds of molecules, hydrocarbon molecules, linked together to form a larger molecule. So organic chemistry is all about splitting up or these chains or adding to them to make longer chains or smaller chains. Mm-hmm. Think of it as kind of a Lego set. And by adding and subtracting molecules, it's possible to make thousands, tens of thousands of different unique substances, molecular substances. And that's what basically all of modern chemistry is about. And it got its start in the 19th century when we started using coal tar as a feedstock for organic chemistry. But then with oil and natural gas, it was possible to use even a greater variety of to produce an even greater variety of organic chemicals. But when the raw crude oil is refined in a refinery, they will, depending on the demand, seek to produce certain blends of gasoline, diesel, and other fuels, and then what's left over often is a heavy, thick, gooey tar that ends up being used for building roads. Generally, what's used for organic chemistry is actually more valuable use of fuel than for making gasoline or diesel. So the chemicals industries and plastics industries will buy whatever natural gas or oil refined products are appropriate for their uses, and typically they're willing to pay a higher price than the gas station down the road.
Well, yeah, I think that that's probably true today, but I think in the beginning, as I saw on TV, that it started out being a fuel, and then we started having all these other products because there was this leftover material, and then now the products are much more valuable than the fuel.
Yeah. What do we do with all of these amazing materials that we can refine from oil? Kerosene, which initially was used as lamp oil as a replacement for whale oil, is now what we use to fuel jet airplanes. Jet fuel is basically the old kerosene that we used to use in kerosene lamps.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting to think about. What if we didn't have fossil fuels? What would we make all these things out of? And I think that we've created, I think you used the term fossil fuel civilization or fossil fuel society, and it really is all the things that we think are so wonderful and marvelous and time saving and all these things really are based in the fact that we've made them from fossil fuels. We've created them from these miraculous materials, and yet there's a supply that is going to end, and then it's not going to be there anymore. So I do want to talk about that. We're coming up on the break. So when we come back, and we still have about a minute, but I don't want to ask you a long question. Well, I'll ask you a question. You can start.
Sure.
So what I want to talk about next is that I've watched your video, 300 Years of Fossil Fuels in 300 Seconds, about five times now, but none of the listeners have seen it. So when we come back from the break, what I'd like you to do is just give us the synopsis.
Sure.
And you don't have to do it in 300 seconds. I'll give you about 8 minutes to talk about how we got from no fossil fuels to our present situation.
Okay,
good. So you're listening to Toxic Free Talk Radio. I'm Deborah Lynn Dadd. My guest today is Richard Heinberg. He is the senior fellow at Post Carbon Institute. Their website is postcarbon.org. And you can go to my website, toxicfreetalkradio.com, and watch his video, 300 Years of Fossil Fuels in 300 Seconds. And we'll be right back. Listening to Toxic Free Talk Radio. I'm Deborah Lynn Dadd, and my guest today is Richard Heinberg. He's from the Post Carbon Institute at postcarbon.org. Okay, Richard, tell us the story.
Okay, well, the story starts in the 19th century when we were using whale oil as a source of illumination. We were using whale oil as lamp oil to light our homes at night. And, of course, whale oil is a renewable resource. Whales reproduce, but we were using it at a rate that was causing the decimation of whale populations around the world. So whale oil was getting more scarce and expensive, and we needed a replacement. Meanwhile, there was oil, a different kind of oil, rock oil, seeping out of the ground in various places around the country, including western Pennsylvania. And this rock oil, or petroleum, was also able to be used with just a little refining as lamp oil. So somebody got the brilliant idea of drilling a well, like a water well, to see if they could get more of this petroleum out of the ground. And it worked, and it resulted in a huge economic boom in Pennsylvania. People were going out and wildcat drilling wells all over the place. Some people got rich. Some people, of course, lost lots of money. And that's been the story with the oil industry ever since, of course. It's a boom and bust kind of industry because it's based on resource extraction. But anyway, along came a clever young chap named John D. Rockefeller, and he figured out how to turn this boom and bust crazy quilt fast-growing industry into a more orderly and organized wealth-producing kind of machine, which became known as Standard Oil, and organized the oil industry very quickly. Folks started looking for ways to put this oil to use in transportation. Very soon, the automobile was invented, and then that led to the, as more and more people wanted automobiles with which to burn gasoline from refined from oil. The problem was, how do you make automobiles fast enough? So a guy named Henry Ford came up with the idea of an automated assembly line, in other words, a powered assembly line, where automobiles could be produced in much higher numbers, much more quickly, and powered assembly lines were then adapted to making other consumer products. So with powered assembly lines, with cheap energy that could also be used to make electricity, which brought energy right into people's homes, so that all you had to do is plug in appliances anywhere in your house, you would have access to energy that would replace muscle power. With all of this, suddenly we had an economic boom like had never been seen before. And the first couple of decades of the 20th century were all about increasing in manufacturing. And manufacturing could occur at such a rate at this point that it actually led to the Great Depression. The problem was overproduction. We were making so much stuff so fast that people couldn't absorb it quickly enough. And so the solution to the Great Depression and to overproduction was a couple of things: advertising, talking people into wanting more stuff, and the other was consumer credit, helping people go into debt to buy stuff they couldn't afford. And we with these two ingredients, we created the consumer society and the consumer economy that was continually growing and depending on people going into ever more debt to buy ever more stuff so that they could keep the engines of production going. And of course,
so here,
more and
if,
more.
If I could just interrupt you for a second, here, it's instead of all, until this point in time, production of everyday household goods was dependent on the need of people, and that people often made their own things, like they would carve things out of wood, they would sew their own clothing, they would grow their own food, and they would produce the amount that they needed, and it was all driven by need. And now, at this point when we're starting to have advertising and debt, it's not driven by need anymore. It's driven by the machines, the need to keep those machines going and continuing the profit of those who own the machines. And this is like not the way nature works, not at all.
Yeah, right. Also, before, our economies were mostly localized. You know, we've always had trade and even long-distance trade, but usually just for luxury goods. The stuff that people really needed, food, furniture, building materials, all of those things came from their immediate regions and vicinities. But with cheap transport fuel, with airplanes and trucks and ships and so on, we began to have what came to be known as globalization. And economists love this. You know, it's called economic efficiency. If you can make something cheaper in China with cheaper labor and cheaper raw materials, then, you know, there's more profit to be made. But, of course, what this does is create economic fluxes where people are, lose their jobs because they can't compete with lower-wage workers on the other side of the planet. and economic disruption, so that every generation, you know, where the economy is shifting to something different. You know, it's one generation, it's computers. The next generation, it's iPhones. The next generation after that, who knows what it's going to be?
Yeah.
So parents and children speak in a different technological language. Don't even know what they're talking about. They lose the same cultural reference. Have different musical tastes and so on. So we've created a very fast-paced society that's dependent on continual growth. And, of course, it's all based on the ever-increasing extraction of non-renewable resources that are depleting in real time.
Yes. And so, well, you did a very good job because you just said all of that in exactly the right amount of time.
Terrific.
When we come back from the break, we're going to hear about what is Richard's vision for what's going to happen when the fossil fuels run out. And maybe you'll tell us when you think that's going to happen and how we can transition into a less fossil fuel, less toxic world, which is what I'm interested in. Is
I'd be happy to talk about that.
That's great. You're listening to Toxic Free Talk Radio. I'm Deborah Lynn Dadd, and my guest today is Richard Heinberg. He's from the Post Carbon Institute, which is at postcarbon.org, and we'll be right back. You're listening to Toxic Free Talk Radio. I'm Deborah Lynn Dadd, and my guest today is Richard Heinberg. He's from the Post Carbon Institute, and they're at postcarbon.org. So, Richard, tell us what's going to happen now with the running out of fossil fuels.
Well, we're seeing the problems associated with depletion, particularly in the oil markets. We're starting to see signs also with coal and natural gas, but I think oil is leading the way. Oil is our most important fossil fuel. Virtually all transportation depends on it, global trade. So oil is really important, and we have been searching for oil and pumping oil out of the ground for many decades now, and we've used the low-hanging fruit principle. In other words, we've gone after the cheapest, best, most accessible oil first. We're not about to run out. There's still lots of oil in the Earth's crust. But as time goes on, what's left to find and to pump is lower and lower grade resources. So we have to use more sophisticated technologies. Here in the United States, we've adapted hydrofracturing or fracking and horizontal drilling in recent years to go after pockets of oil that geologists previously would never have even bothered with. Because better resources were available. Well, those better resources aren't available anymore. So, so now we have to use this sophisticated technology. That means the costs of production are rising very rapidly. So, even though the price of oil fluctuates, it's generally higher than it was a decade or two ago. But the costs of production for the companies themselves are rising faster than prices are. So this is a prescription for problems down the line. Probably before the end of this decade, we'll be seeing another oil shock, either another dramatic price increase or a big consolidation in the oil industry with lots of companies going bust or being bought up by other companies. The oil industry really is showing the initial signs of it's the end of the road. You know, over the course of the next few decades,
yeah,
this is an industry that will be going away.
Well, I remember when I was 16 and I was first learning how to drive, that gas was 25 cents a gallon. And my mother would give me a quarter so I could buy a gallon of gas. And now it's $2.50 a gallon. But the thing that, I think that a lot of people who may be listening and are alive today weren't even alive back in the 80s when we started having the energy crisis. They didn't experience this. But I did experience this, and I think you probably experienced it too. And
that's right.
And so what happened was that I was driving around in my 100-octane Firebird Formula 400, and I couldn't get gas for it because they started diluting all the gas. And I couldn't drive my car. And this was at a time where, for people who weren't there at the time, that there was gas rationing, that we think that these supplies are going to just always be there. But if you were living then, as I was, you were assigned a day of the week when you could buy gas, and cars would line up. You'd have to like spend an hour or more sitting in line at the gas station in order to get your ration gas. And I couldn't, as I said, I couldn't even get gas for my car because it required 100 octane fuel, and the octane was now being diluted down to 85 or something like that. And I had to buy a different car that because I couldn't drive my car. And right. So I have an idea that that's something like that is going to happen again.
Yeah, the energy shocks of the 70s were mostly political in nature, having to do with, you know, politics in the Middle East yeah. and Saudi Arabia and so on. What's happening now is entirely different. You know, we're depleting the high grade resources that drove economic growth during the 20th century. And you know, getting off of oil is going to be an expensive and time consuming process. Because the only real substitutes that we have are battery-powered vehicles, electric cars, or biofuels, you know, making substitute fuels out of food crops. And both of these substitutes are problematic in different ways. And neither of them is going to be a direct drop-in replacement for jet fuel or for the kinds of right. fuels that run global shipping or trucking.
Well, I see my vision. During the break, I was thinking, oh, I should refer to the post-toxic world. Like you,
yeah.
You know, you're post-carbon. I should be post-toxic. My post-toxic vision is that that the whole culture is going to be different because we'll be going to using renewable materials instead of fossil fuels to make most of what we're making. And it'll all go back to being more local, more artisan, those kinds of things. And of course, there are technological things that people can't make at home, like televisions and cell phones and stuff like that. And those will probably still be around, but it'll end up being a lot more local and natural and handmade
right.
than it was prior to fossil fuels. Do you see that that's probably where we're going, or do you have a different
vision? Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, people already are demanding less toxic materials like paints, for example.
Yes.
So companies that make paints are looking for ways to reduce volatile organic compounds, VOCs, which are mostly from fossil fuels.
Right.
Organic paints. Same thing is happening in the chemical industry, the pharmaceutical industry. They're realizing that the days of fossil fuels are numbered. So they're going to have to start using plant-based materials, cornstarch and other materials like that, carbohydrates, to substitute for hydrocarbons. And, of course, in many cases, the substitutes aren't going to be quite as good, at least in the early days. In some cases, they'll be more expensive. But one way or another, it's inevitable that we're going to have to shift away from using fossil fuels as the basis, not only for our energy consumption, but also the chemicals industries and plastics and materials industries and all the rest.
Well, so I actually feel optimistic that the end is in sight, that, you know, that I spend a lot of time. I've spent my entire adult life looking for products that weren't toxic and telling people about them. But it looks like it's going to run its natural course, and that already we're seeing, I mean, I see over a 30-year period that there's more and more less toxic products and non-toxic products and more organic things and all of that. It's starting to emerge. It's like a new phase, a new wave of what's
right.
coming in the future. And
right. Well,
go ahead.
You see, you're at the vanguard of this. Most of industry, most people are still on the fossil fuel bandwagon.
Yes,
and
they are.
And those of us who have decided to get off of fossil fuels before the party is really over, I think we're performing an important function within society as a whole. We're sort of the growing tip of society leading into the inevitable future. And it's going to take experimentation. It's going to take time and investment to get us to a toxic-free, a fossil fuel-free future. So we have to get started now. We can't just wait until all the oil's gone and then try to figure out what to do.
Yeah. I think that somehow I managed to be able to look into the future and see that's where it's going. And I did that many years ago when nobody was talking about this. but I'm glad I did. I mean, it's one of those things where something that was a lemon in my life of being made sick by toxic chemicals turned out to be lemonade on a larger scale, because people like you and I need to be here being the visionaries and doing this and leading it all forward, because that's how things change, is that people have visions and then they say, that's what we should do, this makes sense, and they start making it happen in life, and society shifts. And so I'm glad to know that, I never had thought about the connection. I mean, until I saw that show on TV, The Men Who Built America, and then I saw your video, it wasn't even part of what I was doing to see the fossil fuels as a collaborative kind of movement. Right. Alongside of what I'm doing from the health direction. But I'm glad to see what you're doing, and I'm glad to know that you're there and that people are working on this. So I'm looking at my clock here. Okay, so we've got about a minute left. So any final words you'd like to say?
Well, you know, getting off of fossil fuels in the early stages is going to require more effort and expense. You know, just like finding less toxic foods and paints and products of all kinds takes more effort, and sometimes they're more expensive. But, you know, in the long run, we're doing a service not only to ourselves but also to the rest of society by creating demand for products that will ultimately be necessary for everyone, not just for a niche audience, but for everyone. So, sometimes it feels lonely out there being the only one to be, driving an electric car or whatever, but this is really important work.
It is. Thank you. Thank you. I'm so happy to meet you. And I'm sure we'll be talking again. You're listening to Toxic Free Talk Radio. I'm Deborah Lynn Dadd. Be well.